Okay, I'm on. I'm on. That's good. Okay, I hope you're all here because you like history and you like numbers, because we're going to do a lot of math later on. I'm planning to speak approximately 40 minutes, half of which will be about the history of my topic, and the other half will be lots and lots of numbers, and we're going to do some calculations. First of all, let me just tell you a little bit about myself. I studied Japanese studies in Berlin and in Tokyo. I minored in Russian and in American studies. I decided to go into history for my doctorate, and that's what I'm doing right now in Vienna. Yes, when it comes to history, especially history of Japan, I'm mainly interested in the 20th century, World War II, working on Japanese-American, Japanese-Russian-Soviet relations. And about history, there was a German historian called Leopold von Ranke, who worked in the 19th century, who's considered the father of modern history writing based on sources. And he said the work of a historian should be to tell history as it actually happened, which nowadays is considered a little bit outdated and has actually been called by philosopher Walter Benjamin the strongest narcotic of the 19th century. Because when it comes to working with sources, you can never, I believe, you can never be completely objective. Because everybody, every historian, as objective as he tries to be, always makes choices when he works with the sources, and he makes choices about how to present his findings, knowingly or unknowingly. Because everybody has a certain background, has certain experiences and beliefs, and treats what he finds in his historical sources accordingly. So I'm basically doing research in this field about how historians work with their sources, which you could call meta-history, writing about writing history. And I'm using the case of World War II spy Richard Sorge as an example because it lends itself to this kind of research. It has been written about in very different political climates in very different times. For example, in the Soviet Union, in the German Democratic Republic, in West Germany, in the US, in Japan, to amazingly different results. So, first of all, let me tell you a little bit about Richard Sorge. Richard Sorge was born in 1895 in Baku, which is today Azerbaijan, which was then part of the Russian Empire. His father was a German mining engineer who worked there in the up-and-coming oil industry of Russia. His mother was Russian. He grew up in Berlin. Family moved to Berlin in 1897, and he grew up in a very comfortable environment. The family had money, and he went to school, and in 1914, being a German patriot, he volunteered to go to war. He was wounded twice, and during that time, those 4 years of World War I, he came into contact with communist ideas and eventually became a communist. By the time he got his doctorate in political science from the University of Hamburg, he had joined the Communist Party and was soon noticed by his superiors as a very gifted speaker and agitator. In 1924, he was recruited by the Communist International Organization, the Comintern, was invited to Moscow, And later, some point during the 1920s, joined the Red Army's 4th Department, which was military intelligence. The Red Army's 4th Department in the 1920s started to build an international network of spies and sent Sorge on his first major assignment to Shanghai in 1930. In 1933, he was sent to Tokyo to build his spy ring, which he became famous for later on. In Tokyo, Sorge was very successful setting himself up under the cover of a journalist. He worked for the distinguished German newspaper Frankfurter Zeitung, also several business newspapers. And he also joined the NSDAP to gain access to Tokyo's German community. The thing about Sorge is he was not what you would consider your usual spy, because a spy should be, above all, inconspicuous, I guess. He should not draw a lot of attention to himself. He should not get drunk all the time. And by all means, he should not sleep with other men's wives, I think. Which is exactly what Sorge did. He had an affair with the wife of German Ambassador Eugen Ott. Oh, I'm sorry about the picture, the resolution is not so good. But he still managed to stay his good friend. Somehow, they worked it out. So Sorge was very well known in Tokyo. Everybody knew him, everybody liked him. He was extremely charming. Women liked him, men liked him. And he became a good friend of Ambassador Eugen Ott, who shared with him German reports coming in from Berlin on highly sensitive issues. And in turn got information on Japanese politics from Sorge, who worked with his main Japanese source, Ozaki Hotsumi, a Japanese journalist who had excellent connection into the higher ranks of the Japanese government. And basically got information from the prime minister's advisor and passed this on to Sorge, who in turn informed his friend, the German ambassador, a very workable quid pro quo situation they had going on. All in all, this group Sorge built in Japan, which was named codenamed Ramsey, was relatively small, but is considered one of the most successful examples of human-to-human intelligence. Their main job, which they got from Moscow, was to find out in which direction Japan would eventually expand to the south, which would mean attacking Indochina, Singapore, and getting into conflict with Britain and the USA, or to the north. Japan had already established a puppet regime in Manchuria, and in case Japan would expand to the north, this would mean war with the Soviet Union. Sorge's group was able to predict and report to Moscow not just that in the fall of 1941, Japan actually was not planning to attack to the north, but was going to go to war with the US, but also the exact date and time of the German attack on the Soviet Union in June 1941. I've called them World War II hackers exactly because of what they did. By giving this kind of information to Moscow, Sorge and his group tried to hack the outcome of World War II, I think you can say. Some historians consider them to have been incredibly successful in that. Some say that their influence was basically irrelevant because, unfortunately, Stalin did not believe Sorge's report, as other spy groups in Western Europe told him about the German attack, he just didn't want to believe that. And he called Sorge an unbelievable little, I'm going to censor myself, who just spends the Soviet Union's money in Japan and has a good life and should not be believed. For this talk, I'm not going into detail about Stalin's reaction to Sorge's reports or even on the very accidental discovery of Sorge's group by the German, by the Japanese secret police, which happened in October of 1941, because that would be out of the scale of what I'm intending. Instead, I'd like to talk about the technical and cryptological aspects of Sorge's work a little bit in more detail, which is in part why I submitted this talk, because I've read a lot about this case, but I've always sort of skimmed over the cryptological parts, because there's like pages and pages of numbers and calculations, and I always thought, yeah, okay, interesting, let's move on. So to present this to you, I actually got into detail and learned how to encrypt and decode the messages Sorge sent to the Soviet Union. Fact is, for example, on June 1st, 1941, the Red Army in Moscow received this telegram from its Far East branch, which was probably located in Vladivostok. Should I read this? Yes? Well, the first sentence is Berlin informiroval svojevo posla v Japoniji od što nemieckoje nastuplenie protiv SSSR начнется во второй половине июня. It says in English, Berlin has informed its ambassador in Japan, Ott, that the German attack against the Soviet Union will start in the second half of June. So this was sent from the Red Army in Vladivostok, from military intelligence in Vladivostok to Moscow. But how did this information get to Vladivostok? To show you how this happened, how this got to the Red Army's military intelligence in the Far East of Siberia, I'd like to introduce you to a very sympathetic hacker named Max Clausen. Again, sorry about the picture. I couldn't find a really good picture of him in his younger days. This is, I think, his passport picture. Max Clausen was German, born on the island of Nordstrand in North Frisia. He grew up in very poor conditions. His family was poor. He wanted to be a mechanic, but couldn't afford the apprenticeship, which cost money, so he had to become a farmhand. He joined the army in 1917, and through a stroke of luck, he was taught to be a radio technician for the Kaiser's army. Just like Sorge, he developed communist leanings during the war through his experiences in World War I, turned communist, and used his knowledge that he got in the army to become a radio communication engineer, and he learned encryption for his work in the Communist Party of Germany and later the Soviet Union. So in the 1920s, he also was invited to work in Moscow and made a name for himself through what he could do as a radio technician, and was sent to Tokyo in 1935. As you can see, he survived the war. This is a picture from his later years. I can maybe, if we have time, go into detail about what happened to all these people at the end of the war, after the war, but that's not really what I want to talk about. In 1935, Clausen arrived in Tokyo, and his job was to build a radio transmitter and receiver. He was not allowed to carry any technical equipment with him, nothing, not one vacuum tube, not one coil that he might need. His only instructions were to use a wavelength between 37 and 39 meters for transmitting, between 45 and 48 meters for receiving. The rest was up to him and his experience to build a transmitter and receiver from scratch, using parts he could find at Tokyo radio supply shops without drawing any suspicion to himself. For example, he could not buy a Morse transmitter key, because that would have brought the police to his door very quickly. So he built his transmitter key using a wooden butter form. The transmitter he built consisted of a bakelite panel attached to a wooden box, about the size of a laptop. He used two vacuum tubes, two coils, which could be mounted and dismounted, making this whole set very portable. He could fit it into a suitcase and carry it around, which he did. I don't know if anybody in here is a ham radio enthusiast. In that case, you could probably explain to me better than I could what all these diagrams mean. I'm sure it is, if you're not a historian. Well, anyway, the receiver he used was basically a simple ham radio. He used headphones instead of a speaker, making it portable to fit into his suitcase, and he just modified it for shortwave reception. Clausen was actually able to set up his whole set in under 10 minutes. He avoided using outside antenna, instead always working in wooden houses on the second floor, attaching an antenna of about 7 meters to the roof. His receiver's antenna was only about 1 meter. That's this one here. And he had some rules. He always used densely populated areas of Tokyo, which made it harder for the police to find out where exactly the signal was coming from. He always used wooden houses, which at that time were a lot in Tokyo. Always used two-story houses. So with this, I understand, very simple set, he was able to reach the Soviet Far East 2,000 kilometers away. According to him, after the war, he explained how he built this whole thing and how he worked it. He said that atmospheric conditions were always best around sunrise and sunset, and I guess he didn't like to get up early, so he often worked around sunset, often for 4 hours on end, sometimes changing locations in between twice, driving to another friend's house, setting up again in under 10 minutes, and going at it again. The Japanese secret police was actually on his case for a couple of years. They noticed that somebody was sending something and receiving something somewhere, but they had no idea where exactly. They couldn't pinpoint him. And they had no idea what the gibberish he was sending and receiving meant, because the things they could intercept looked basically like this. This was sent back and forth between Tokyo and, as the Japanese police believed, maybe somewhere in Korea, because who could get any farther than Korea? It's impossible. So these columns of numbers, the police wrote them down. intelligence tried to figure out what they meant, but they had no idea. What this message actually says is this. First, DAL, which stands for Dalny Vostok, Far East in Russian. Then the message, which was sent in September of 1941. The Soviet Far East can be considered safe from a Japanese attack. Ramsey, which was the code name of Zarga's group. And now, yes, we have good time. I'd like to look a little bit and walk you through how this becomes that in the end. It's very easy, and it was uncrackable. The secret police of Japan only found out how these messages were encoded after they had, by accident, stumbled upon Zarga's group, arrested them, and asked them what they were. So first of all, these messages were always written in German. Why is that funny? First was always DAL, which was the code for Far East, then the message, which sometimes was longer. Sometimes, like I said, Clausen sent for like 4 hours, and he sent about 23,000, 29,000 words per year. Sometimes these messages were much longer, but we don't have that much time today. So that was what Clausen started with. First of all, he gave every letter in the English alphabet one number. The most common letters got single-digit numbers. The others got numbers between 80 and 99. And then he went to give every word its numbers. So DAL is 83593, DIA is 8334, and so on and so forth. And he put all these numbers into blocks of five. And I think we can agree that that is not very safe. I'm sure everybody here could crack that code with a little bit of time, because those very common letters have always the same numbers, and you can basically derive where the E's are and where the A's are. So what we need is a second code. We need a book cipher. And to use a book cipher, we need a book, which the person who encodes the messages and the person who decodes the messages knows about, and nobody else knows about. That's important. And it has to be a very common, inconspicuous book. This is the statistical yearbook for the German Reich. In 1941, Clausen used the year of 1935. And it was very inconspicuous to have this, because Clausen was a businessman in Tokyo. Zarga was a journalist writing for business newspapers. He needed these statistics. This book basically consists of pages and pages of tables and charts full of numbers. So what we do now is we pick a page, any page, which has a nice table with lots of numbers. Let's say page 193. It's something about travel in the most important German harbors, whatever. Then we pick a line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, line 7 from the top, and we pick column, we don't care about the year, we just pick column 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Line 7, it's 113. And to confuse us even more, we start with the last number, 3. Then we just go round, next line, and so on. And we write the first 5 numbers under the 5 numbers of the alphabet code. What now? add this up. So we add up 8 and 3, it's 11. We omit the first 1, we have 1. 3 and 5 is 8. 5 and 6 is 11 again. 9 and 3 is 12. 3 and 5 is 8, and so on and so forth. The finished code is basically this. Again, we have columns of 5. Okay, that's too far. This is our result. This is what we send to Vladivostok. But now, our recipient needs to know which page we have been using, of course, because otherwise they would be searched forever. So we take the page number 193, the line and the column. We add this to the fourth block of 5 numbers from the top and the third block of 5 numbers from the bottom, and we get 51833. And we put this on top of our message. So that's what we just Morse code to Vladivostok. And Vladivostok goes, okay, 51833 is the result of this plus this somehow. We get 4 plus 0 is 4, we need 5, so 1. 6 plus 6 is 12, we need 1, the next one would be 21, 9. 1 plus 4 is 5, we need 8, so 3. 1 plus 5 is 6, we need to get to 13, 7. 8 plus 0 is 8, we need to get to 13 again, 5. So it's page 193, line 7, column 5. And we do all this in reverse, and we get to, the Soviet Far East can be considered safe from a Japanese attack. And of course, we do this without a computer, we use paper and pen. And Clausen said he was able to encode 500 blocks of these 5 numbers in 1 hour. He was that good. And then what we also need is to make an appointment for the next contact, which was always put at the end of every message. Relatively simple. Every day of the week was encoded. I don't know if anybody can guess what this is, how you get to these letters. If you read them from the top, it's actually... it's the first 21 letters of a common German saying, Morgenstunde hat Gold im Munde, which is basically German for the early bird catches the worm. Because, you know, atmospheric conditions during sunrise, which Clausen did not appreciate so much. But, so we take these first 21 letters, every day gets 3, Monday is MTT, Tuesday is OUG. And then let's say the next contact is on Tuesday the 31st, next week. Because usually contacts were made once a week. Clausen transmitted about 60 times in 1939, about 60 times in 1940. So everybody always knew it's the next Tuesday. That was clear. So it's Tuesday, the 31st at 1500 Greenwich Mean Time. That would be 31 plus 15 is 46. So Tuesday 46. Well, that's it, basically. Well, I'm very fast. I thought I would take too long. Anyway, you're lucky today because I tried to upload this alphabet with the corresponding numbers and give you a little homework to do. I tried to upload this, which is basically all you need to do this kind of encryption. You need this alphabet, you need to know the book, you need to just pick any page, line, and column, and then you need to, at the end, encode the page, line, and column using the fourth group of five from the top and the third group of five from the bottom. And I wanted to upload that so you could look at it, but the page didn't really work today. I couldn't upload it. And I wanted to just ask you to encode this. You can find the statistical yearbook on www.digizeitschriften.de, and you could email me. You can also email me if you have any questions later on. And now I think we still have good time, so anything else? Thank you.
Okay, so sorry, I have no microphone, so no moderation. If you have questions, just please line up at the two microphones here in the room. There's one over there and one here where I'm standing. We also have questions from the internet at from our lovely signal angel in the back. So because there's no one standing here at the microphone, we'll just start with one question from IRC.
Okay, the question from IRC is, how did they know when the transmit starts? Did they just send the whole message once at the specific time, or was there some scheme to say when the transmission starts?
Well, basically, yes. They just had, at the end of each message, they had this simple code when they would transmit again, like next Tuesday at 1500. And the person on the other hand, which on the other end, would just stand by and listen. And if conditions were good and they came true, then they just did it at 1500. I think that was, yeah. And to make sure that it was actually the right person transmitting, you had this code, DAL, was Zaga, was the Far East. So Vladivostok knew that it was Zorge and not somebody else by starting the message always with DAL. I hope that answers the question.
I have a question that's probably more for the audience. And that's, I was wondering how long it would take with Google scanning all those books. If you picked one random book you have as a favorite with a friend, how long it would actually take if you would use a very similar principle, but not maybe the same row and the same column, to actually crack that and to get to know which book is needed to decipher that?
Anybody?
Anyone? An educated guess?
Longer than Congress.
I have an idea. There is a statistical phenomenon that numbers occur in different amounts in every paper and in every stack of... Okay, for the first digit, and I don't know which how it's called, and maybe this is a side way you can attack this code. But I don't know. I'm not very good at encoding. Okay. Here's something. Someone says the take the last digit and not the first. And this phenomenon is related to the first digit. And one is the most common number in that. And so if they take the last digit, it's not a solution.
And I just wanted to thank the speaker for that very interesting talk about analog crypto.
You're welcome.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for the talk. Also, was very interesting. I was wondering who came up with that kind of code. Was it Zorge himself, or Klausen, or what his name was, or the German, no, not German, the Russian military, or whoever?
Yes, basically, the Russian military intelligence instructed Zorge not on which book to pick, but they came up with this kind of encryption, of course. And first, Sorge did the encryption himself up to 1937, because actually it was a rule that the one that the person transmitting should not do the encoding for safety reasons. So first of all, Sorge did the encryption and gave the sheets of numbers to Clausen, who then sent them. But in 1938, Sorge had a pretty serious motorcycle accident while driving drunk, and he then taught Clausen how to encode the messages, and Clausen was actually better at it. He was faster.
Okay. So. Thanks.
Hello. I just wanted to state that between a safe and an unsafe encryption is just one bit. There's another speech later
yes,
in the days.
I know.
In this case, if the first letters DAL were always the same, this something like this was taken to crack Enigma messages.
Yes.
And of course, adding something, not multiplying, is a weak, quite weak encryption. So if you have the chance to multiply something with such a table or to adding mm-hmm. Must not be the best.
Yes.
And I don't think that this would be done today.
No. So if, oh. Well, I just like to say the question always when you do this kind of hand encryption is convenience and safety. I mean, if you have a very, very, very safe encryption, it just gets too complicated and too hard to encrypt this by hand. So you have to find like a middle way between convenience, what you can do without, you know, working round the clock on it, and safety, I guess.
Is it known how he first exchanged the ciphers with the Russians? You said he wasn't told which book to use or what cipher. Where did he first tell them how he encoded his messages?
Well, in the early years he spent in Japan, there were also other contacts. He had microfilm smuggled to the Soviet Union, and in some cases, there were actually people contacting the Soviet embassy, which was an absolute no-go, which was too dangerous. But at first, they had other means of communication, like the classic spy, which you see in spy movies, that they meet somewhere and they just exchange stuff and exchange suitcases and things.
Another question from the internet.
So yeah, the internet would like to know if this kind of book cipher was already in use before, or this was the first time, and whether is it still actually in use?
Well, it was certainly used before. It was used. I'm not sure if before the Soviet Union, but it was used in other cases, especially in Russian history. I can't really come up with a special group right now who used this, but Sorge was not the first who this was invented for.
And the second part of the question was...
Oh, yeah. Actually, the second part of the question was, is this still being used?
Yeah.
Yes? Well, who still uses analog encryption?
Serial killers, too.
I'm sorry?
There was a column in a blog from a cryptologist, and there are mm-hmm. some cases like the Zodiac Killer did this. He was...
Yes. I was going to say not exactly, maybe not in the sense of, you know, big politics, but of course, Yeah, crazy people like the Zodiac Killer use encryption hand. And no, it's a good example. And I mean, children do this, of course, because it's fun.
Another question.
One short note, I think at least up until the 80s, similar ciphers were used to decrypt messages from number stations, I think. So I mean, a bit more complicated and not with, with adding and with one-time pads, but it's quite similar.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Another question is, this system is more or less just a substitution letter. So you just have the thing, you have the code in linear form and you don't change it, you just add or subtract values. Especially in Second World War II, they were also used still some transposition codes. Why didn't they, where you put it into a square and then you change columns and things like this, why didn't they use this one in this case?
Well, why they didn't use it, I'm sure they were able to use it, but actually, I'm not sure if there are any sources out there on this early time of the Sorge group, his instructions he got. There are some sources have been published in the 1990s after the Russian archives were opened for a while and books have been published. For example, these messages with the exact dates and these telegrams were published. And then after 2000, in the era of Putin, a lot of archives have been closed again. And I haven't come across anything about this early instructive era of Sorge's time in Moscow, where he actually got his instructions, why they picked that code over another one.
I'm hearing we might have an answer from our very intelligent crowd. So.
Okay.
Okay, the encryption that was used has two parts. One is this static substitution, which is quite insecure, but the book code is quite secure unless the book is known, which is used for it. So you have no way to find out which way to which book he uses.
Yeah.
So you also have no way to crack this code. So it's a quite secure method to encrypt, and it's even more secure than the method you suggested. And there was another question because why they didn't use multiplication instead of addition.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is that they used addition modulo 10, which wouldn't work if they used multiplication.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just wouldn't have worked out.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Exactly. If you just multiply, yes.
Because as long as you have an addition of two single-digit values,
yes,
you'll stay somewhere between 0 and 18. So you know where you come out.
Yes.
And if you multiply them, you can go up to 81.
Yes, exactly. And then you have no idea what the last number will be. Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
I was wondering how they came up with this substitution cipher, these numbers. You said the most common letters were single digit and the other ones were in the range of 80 and 90. Is there any mathematical property to that they choose these numbers, or just for fun?
Does anybody think there's any mathematical reason, or was Sorge just drunk and came up with that? I think both could be.
It's a valid reason.
Valid.
Yeah. All right.
But there, I think somebody knows it.
The point is that you have to be without prefix. So if you have 1 and 88, you have to be sure that you have no letter encoded with 18. Because you have to distinguish those. Yeah, it's a Huffman encoding. And you just ensure that you don't have any prefix in another code.
Right.
So 1 is A, so you have no other letter starting with 1. And then you end up with 88 for Q or something like that.
Ah, yes. Okay, so it was not just a drunk idea. Good.
The important part,
it's good to know.
The important part at that point is that you don't use the numbers 8 and 9 with this encryption for the single digit codes.
Somebody is, yeah.
In terms of historical usage of book codes, I know that the British Special Operations Executive was using book ciphers during the Second World War. In fact, Leo Marx, who was SOE's code master, added an additional layer of security by scrapping the idea of using books. He simply wrote a poem for each member of SOE, handed them the piece of paper, and said, "This is your cipher," cool. So that he and the actual spy were the only people who had it. Mm-hmm. But you did say if you had time, you'd finish the story. What yes. happened to everyone?
What happened to everyone? Yes, let's, okay, good. Yeah, I'm glad. There's one more question, maybe, and then I can tell what happened, or?
The internet would like to know. The internet would like to know what source said he was drunk, and has he been punished for this kind of behavior?
I'm sorry, again, what?
The internet would like to know which source says he was drunk all the time, and whether he has been punished for this.
Yes. Yes. The sources on Sorge's colorful life. Basically, yeah. His people who knew him. He was just known in this community. He was a playboy, and he had some trouble with alcohol and. So many people reported on that after the war that we can just assume that this is true. This has been dramatized in, especially in West German writing on Sorge. There even have been movies about him. I can recommend, if you'd like, some entertainment on this case. I'd recommend the German-Japanese co-production called Spy Sorge. It was published in 2003. It's very long, and it's a very good actor playing Sorge. And there's a lot on this reckless behavior he showed. And it's actually quite interesting that this has been his being drunk all the time, his affairs with women, has been pointed out in West German publications on his case. Obviously, the Soviet Union and the German Democratic Republic, who tried to make him a hero, did not talk about this. Does that answer the internet's question?
I suppose so. Thank you.
Good.
I actually happen to have a book here that explains how we came up with the substitution cipher.
Which one? Which one is it?
It's just a bit difficult to explain
which book?
Just in words here, but it's okay. It's based on a arbitrary password, which was Subway. And also a memorable phrase for the 8 most frequent letters in the language,
okay.
Which were, interestingly enough, the sentence, a sin to err, which is, as the book puts it, good advice for a spy.
Okay. Which book is that? I can't.
Decrypted Secrets by...
Ah, okay. So it's a book about, you know, encryption in general.
Yes, okay, but it has a lot of stuff about historic encryption.
Mm-hmm. And about Sorge.
Not a lot of stuff about Sorge.
But yeah, a little bit. Yeah, he's mentioned in a lot of books on intelligence, history of intelligence in general. So what happened to everybody? The Japanese secret police, by accident, discovered this group in 1941, they were looking for something completely different. They were looking for Japanese communists. And Zarge's group was, he had this, his main Japanese man, who in turn had Japanese informants, and some of them had connections to Japanese American communists. And this somehow, it's not quite clear who actually talked in the end, who actually pointed out this whole connection going from Japanese American communists to Japanese communists to Ozaki to Zaga, and which set up this chain reaction leading to the arrest of Zaga and his compatriots. But fact is, in October of 1941, Zaga, Ozaki, Clausen, everybody else in his group was arrested. And the Japanese actually thought that Zaga was a German spy, which was an uncomfortable situation because Japan and Germany had a pact. They were allies, and that was very sensitive to have someone to believe he's been spying for Germany in Japan. And even the German ambassador couldn't believe that Zaga had betrayed him. And at some point, everybody just talked. Because I think in October 1941, Zaga was very sick. He was disillusioned because nobody had believed him. He got negative messages from Moscow, basically saying that he was a liar and his information was wrong. He had personal trouble, and he thought, okay, his mission is over. He has informed the Soviet Union about everything. So at some point, I believe he just gave up and he talked. And Clausen talked, and the Japanese secret police finally found out what these numbers meant, because Clausen explained it all. And then Zaga and Ozaki were sentenced to death under the Japanese peace preservation law, which did not actually apply to what they did, but it was not a fair trial. It was war, and they fabricated something. And after Zaga was sentenced to death, Japan tried to exchange him. They contacted Moscow trying to exchange Zaga for a Japanese spy. And Moscow said, we have no idea who you're talking about. We don't know this person. And in the end, in November of 1944, Zaga and Ozaki were executed. Clausen was sentenced to life in prison, was released. In 1945, when the Japanese peace preservation law was rescinded and political prisoners were let go, and before the American authorities even realized who they had just let out of prison there, the Soviet Union came in and whisked Clausen and his wife out of the country. And they were allowed to move to Berlin. At first, until 1964, during the still Stalinist era, there was no talk at all about the Zaga case in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Germany. And after 1964, Zaga was made to be a hero of the Soviet Union. It was actually the first time that the Soviet Union officially acknowledged that they had spies elsewhere. And then after 1964, Clausen and his wife became minor celebrities in the GDR, going on talking tours in schools, telling about their heroic duties during the war. Who else? Well, yes, Zaga was executed, Ozaki as well. One other member of his group, one European who worked for a French newspaper, died in prison in the beginning of 1945. Zaga's Russian wife was deported to Siberia to shut her up and died also of the harsh conditions before the war was over.
Okay, that's not a very happy
point to end. Not a happy ending, I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry for the mood kill. But yeah, we finished perfectly on time now.
Perfect.
Yeah, very nice. Thank you again very, very much. That was really interesting.